A reading from the prophet Micah. Hear what the Lord says. O my people, what have I done to you? In what have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. And I sent before you Moses, Aaron, and Miriam. O my people, remember now what King Balak of Moab devised, and what Balaam, son of Beor, answered him, and what happened from Shittim to Gilgal, that you may know the saving acts of the Lord. With what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? Shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? Will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? Shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? He has told you, O mortal, what is good. And what does the Lord require of you but to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God? Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
The Holy Gospel of our Lord Jesus Christ according to Matthew. As Jesus was walking along, he saw a man called Matthew sitting at the tax booth. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he got up and followed him. As Jesus sat at dinner in the house, many tax collectors and sinners came and were sitting with him and his disciples. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to his disciples, "Why does your teacher eat with tax collectors and sinners?" But when Jesus heard this, he said, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. Go and learn what this means. I desire mercy, not sacrifice. For I have come to call not the righteous, but sinners." The Gospel of Christ.
Over the last number of weeks, as we have been working through the narrative lectionary, we spent a lot of time in the first five books of the Bible, known as the Pentateuch, or as the Hebrew people would call them, the Torah. And there we see the foundation of how it is Israel understood itself and how they understood their relationship with Yahweh, their God, was to be. Then we moved into the book of Joshua and talked about how it was that they came into the promised land and settled that land and established it for their own. And then we skipped the book of Judges, and over the past 3 weeks while I've been away, we explored what it was like while the kingdom was united under one king. King David was highlighted 3 weeks ago, and we saw that he had clay feet, guilty of adultery and murder, and his bad choices caused some challenges down the road. And then his son Solomon, the week after, though he was one who received great wisdom from God, for some reason did not choose to hold on to that wisdom. And as a result of his reign, ultimately the kingdom after him split into two, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. But even while this was going on, God was continuing to perform what it was that God had intended should be the case for Israel all along. Because back in Genesis, God had said to Abraham that through you and through your descendants, all the nations of the world will be blessed. And last week, as Margaret was preaching about Naaman the Syrian, a guy who wasn't even from Israel, through the prophet Elisha, was able to receive healing of his leprosy because God so chose to extend grace to those outside of Israel. This whole story of Israel's history is found in the first number of books in the Bible. And we've talked through those already. The first five books, Joshua, then Judges, which we skipped, represents a couple hundred years of history where the 12 tribes of Israel were just on their own, kind of working together. And every once in a while, there would be a challenge come up in the area, and a local leader, a judge, would be raised up to help deal with the opponents of Israel at that time. But then, around 1000 BCE, that kingdom was established under first Saul, then David, then Solomon, and during this time emerged what is known as the ministry of the prophets. And here we're talking about the books 1 and 2 Samuel and 1 and 2 Kings in the Hebrew Bible. 1 and 2 Samuel cover off with Saul and David, and we get into 1 and 2 Kings, it's Solomon and the divided kingdom. And the prophets were people that rose up from time to time in order to remind the people, and the leaders in particular, that they were to maintain their constant readiness to follow what was illustrated in the Torah, the law of God, what it is that Yahweh had said the people of Israel were to do. Now, not all of the prophets wrote something down. In David's case, we learned that it was the prophet Nathan who brought attention to his sinful behavior. And then with last week, it was the prophet Elisha who was used during this time to deal with Naaman the Syrian. But what we have in the following and latter part of the Hebrew Bible, a list of 17 prophetic books, things that were written down. And when you get to these books in the Hebrew Bible, you can wonder how they're supposed to work. Because when you start in Genesis and work your way through all these books, as I described, and 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, then you've got some poetry in the middle, and then you have these 17 prophets, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, Hosea, Jonah, Micah, which is who we heard of today. And you read that and you wonder, how does this fit with the story that I've already read? And the key thing for us to understand, it is when we are in this period shown in 1 and 2 Kings that all of these prophetic books fit in there somehow. You'll see these prophetic books identifying who the kings were at the time when the prophet did their ministry. And so it does take a little bit of work to find out how it fits in. But if you've ever tried reading the Hebrew Bible and gotten lost in the prophets, that's part of the reason. It all fits back into a part of history that you've already read. But the other thing that makes the prophets difficult to listen to is it seems to be the same basic story. It seems to be the same message. Judgment. Israel, you've done wrong. You have not been following the law of God. You have not been following the Torah that Yahweh gave you. This is bad. Bad things are going to happen. Come on, you guys, get it together. Let's smarten up and do the right thing. And after you read that over and over and over again, it can become really disheartening. But there is good reason for that message to be there. And remember now that all these prophets were doing this at different times in the history of Israel. But it was important because of that original intention that God had indicated to Abraham back in Genesis 12 and 15 and 17. This is my intention, God is saying. I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to give you a land. Yeah, this all starts because you're going to have a son. And again, through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed. God's intention for everything that he was going to do with the Israelites, and this is what they describe in their history, is that they were to bless the world. Now, the neat thing about this is to recognize that this is God's intention. It isn't Israel waking up one day thinking, you know what, we're pretty cool people. I think we could bless the world. So why don't we take it upon ourselves to go ahead and make this world a better place because we're such great people? No, it wasn't that at all. It was God saying, I am choosing you in order to get this done. My intention is to bring blessing. I am going to do it through you. And so in order for Israel to know what kind of nation they were to be, that this could indeed be done, this is why God gives the Torah. 613 laws about how to get it done. When we get to 1 and 2 Kings, and the kingdom has been divided, and now you have a northern kingdom and a southern kingdom often in conflict with each other, it doesn't take long to find that the Israelites are having a hard time living up to those 613 commands. But it's important because of what God's intention is. So the prophets stand up and say to the king and to the people, we got to get this right. So this is why their message is so emphatic. It is not just you guys aren't doing well following rules. It's you guys are not being who you're supposed to be. Now in the book of Micah, What has happened here? In 722 BCE, the northern kingdom of Israel was defeated by the Assyrians, and it was just gone. Like Margaret said in her sermon last week, these are the lost tribes of Israel. They're just gone. It's been erased. There's nothing left of that northern kingdom. All that's left is the southern kingdom of Judah with its capital city of Jerusalem. And Micah starts his prophetic ministry just a few years before that northern kingdom is defeated. But now that that has happened, Micah is saying even more to the people who remain, guys, look what's just happened to the north. We have to pay attention to this. We need to make sure that we're doing things the right way. And so his book actually happens to be one of the heavier ones when it comes to this message of prophetic judgment. Look, you guys, if you don't do this, bad things are going to happen. And that's, again, what makes it hard to read. But he does also include these messages of hope, that there's a light at the end of the tunnel if they would get it right. And at the end of the book, it's only seven chapters, and in chapter 6, he sets up this scenario to try to grab the people's attention so that they can understand what's going on here. And he begins by asking some rhetorical questions on behalf of Yahweh. This is what we opened up the passage with. And what he says on behalf of Yahweh is this: O my people, what have I done to you? In what have I wearied you? Answer me. For I brought you up from the land of Egypt and redeemed you from the house of slavery. And he goes on to recount the things that Israel knows well of its history. And so God is saying, what's happening? What have I done wrong? And of course, the answer is that God hasn't done anything wrong. Israel is the one that had been missing the boat. And so after putting out these rhetorical questions on behalf of God, then Micah turns around and asks a series of rhetorical questions on behalf of the people of Israel, assuming that they have responded positively to this thing and are saying, you know what, we do have to get something right. So how are we going to do this? What is the way that we have to approach God again? How can we get this right? And he asks these questions: with what shall I come before the Lord and bow myself before God on high? So he begins with this: shall I come before him with burnt offerings, with calves a year old? This would be a logical answer. After all, the Torah talks about the sacrificial system, and many of the laws there are all about how to come and appropriately worship God. And so if you've got a calf that's a year old, and if it is a good quality calf like it's supposed to be, this is a rather costly thing to do. If you're trying to make things right with God and use the sacrificial system as an ancient Israelite, you're going to bring this calf to the temple. It's going to be sacrificed, and it's going to be completely burned up as an offering to God. Is that what we need to do? Micah asks on behalf of the people. But then he ramps it up again. Or will the Lord be pleased with thousands of rams, with 10,000s of rivers of oil? I mean, here he just goes right into hyperbole. If one calf isn't enough to do it, maybe if I bring 1,000 sheep and sacrifice all of them and all the oil to go with it, which was also part of the sacrifices, will the Lord then be pleased with that? Is that what it takes to get things right with God? And then they ramp it up one more time. Micah says, shall I give my firstborn for my transgression, the fruit of my body for the sin of my soul? Over and over again, Yahweh says, look, I don't want you to sacrifice your kids to me. But here, Micah still pulls that card out. Is this what it takes? How do we make right with God? Do I sacrifice my oldest child as the most expensive offering I can give? Will that grab God's attention? But Micah interestingly says, no, actually, none of that. He has shown you, O mortal, what is good, and what does the Lord require of you? But to do justice and to love kindness and to walk humbly with your God. Micah's answer completely goes in a different direction than they were expecting. When the 613 laws of the Torah have so many of them built around the sacrificial system, it's easy to think that the way to get right with Yahweh is to make sure you do your sacrifices right and that you are worshiping correctly and that you are coming to the temple like you should and you are walking through the liturgy, shall we say, in an appropriate and excellent manner. Because after all, isn't that what God's pleased with? Aren't our praises the thing that God looks for? And yet that's not what Micah says. What Micah is doing with this answer, these three things, do justice, love kindness, and walk humbly with your God, he is pointing away from the mechanism of worship and pointing to the result of what that worship is supposed to produce. He moves away from just following these sets of rules and says, guys, the issue is who it is that you are. That's the point that Yahweh is trying to make. This is the issue that I'm prophesying to you about. When you read the letter, you will find in several places when Micah lists the concerns that he has with what he sees in Israel, he's saying, you guys aren't taking care of those who are in difficult circumstances. Instead, we see the rich getting richer on the backs of the poor. We are seeing injustice happening, and people are not receiving the equity and the equal treatment they ought to have. People are not being treated with dignity. Instead, people are being trampled underfoot. This is not the way it's supposed to be. And in those three statements, doing justice, loving kindness, and walking humbly with your God, Micah effectively summarizes all 613 commands into those three. And it's all about what kind of people the Israelites were to be. Now, that's an interesting thing to hear, to basically see that it wasn't about performing acts of worship perfectly, but it was about how you related to each other. And in so doing, then, walking with humility before the God who was saying, this is the kind of people you should be. Jesus carries this on when he shows up later, about 700 years later. He summarizes the 613 laws of the Torah into two, love God and love your neighbor, right? And then the Apostle Paul, after that, especially in the letter to the Galatians, will say that all of the commandments, indeed any law that can be given, can be summed up in this one command, love your neighbor as yourself. And what that is pointing us to is that all 613 laws given earlier, all the way through the scriptures, bring us to this singular point that it is how we live out as followers of Jesus, as the people of God, that really matters. And so this is why Micah's words to Israel 2,700 years ago can have application for us. Not that we have to read all of the words of judgment upon us and feel, oh, we're just terrible people, and Micah just reminds us again, and oh God, we're so unworthy, can you do anything with us? No. But instead to point to this verse and understand that the reason we gather as we do on Sundays is not to be good at our liturgy. Not that that's a bad thing. It's a lovely thing to offer beautiful worship to God, but the bottom line is what happens after we leave here. And this is why at the end of the service, we will say, let us go forth in peace to love and serve the Lord, because everything that happens here is not the main event. It is about our activity outside of these walls. So let's just look briefly at those three things that Micah said. The last one, of course, walking humbly with our God. That one, I think, certainly summarizes love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. It speaks to the idea that we recognize that we are to live our lives in a way that pleases God, that pleases the divine, that is in step with that transcendent presence that is the source of all being that we describe in the Bible as being God. We realize that we live not just for ourselves. And so that is one thing that we need to do. But the other two things actually are rather costly. Let's start with the first one. We are to do justice. Some translations of the Bible say that we are to act justly, but that's an unfortunate way to translate it. Part of the reason is when you have the word act in your mind, it can easily be taken to mean that you're acting, right? You're putting on a show, you're faking it till you make it, or something like that. And that is not at all what the intention is behind this observation. We are not simply to try to pretend, you know, we are not simply just to put on a show, but we are certainly to take action. But this is why it's better just to say we are to do justice. What it is that we are to be accomplishing in our lives is to be things that are just for all around us. This is why loving our neighbors as ourselves is so important. We ought to look for opportunities for people to be seen with the dignity that they possess as creations of God. We need to be ones who are ready to show that dignity by including people and by just being nice to people and actually giving people credit for who they are. And on top of that, doing justice means involving ourselves in situations where, if we see an injustice, that we somehow take some kind of action to see that change. Sometimes that's through political action. Sometimes it means stepping into a situation where something bad is going on. Sometimes it means trying to change the rules in an organization you might be part of to make sure that it's more equal. There's any number of ways that we could do this, but it does tend to take more effort than just being nice to people. Doing justice means being on the lookout for one another and trying to see that we would be included in a positive way. And we start by practicing that as people of the same parish. The other one about loving kindness, it's kind of a weak way to put it. Loving mercy is another way it's been translated. The Hebrew word actually underneath kindness or mercy is actually the word for steadfast love. And in the book of Psalms, we hear about God's steadfast love being celebrated in almost every one of those 150 pieces of music. This is the thing that we are to love ourselves, to love steadfast love, to love the mercy that gives people the benefit of the doubt, the kind of love that looks at people with compassion. If we are people that operate in that way, then not only do we find ourselves as a family working well together and loving each other and being able to enjoy being with each other because we are offering this give and take with one another, but we also can begin to set an example of what loving Christian fellowship ought to be. And this is an extension of what God promised Abraham way back in Genesis, that all the nations in the world would be blessed through Abraham's descendants. In a spiritual sense, we are Abraham's descendants. We carry the same mission that Israel did. And we can, by demonstrating what solid community looks like, begin to paint a picture that when other people encounter it, they can say, that's something I want to be part of. This isn't really a reach when you think about it. We have a great number of people who immigrate to Canada. Why? Because Canada has developed a reputation of being a place that has universal health care. And we have real elections. We don't just have one candidate that we all have to vote democratically for, and oh, look, he came in, surprise, surprise, right? The reputation of our country has gone around the world, and people go, I want a piece of that. I'm going to move there because this is a better country to live in. If that can happen just on the basis of political realities, how much more then if people begin to see a life lived together, a life that is shared, that demonstrates these qualities with hands held out to others and saying, you can be part of this too. And when our neighbors see that in us, when our coworkers see this kind of attitude and approach that we offer to them, I don't think it can help but be attractive. And through that, they can be blessed not only by our generosity and compassion, but by their interest and participation and even simply exploration of what it is that we are trying to live by as the people of God, as the followers of Jesus, as those who would take seriously the challenge Micah held out 2,700 years ago. So let us be ones who consider, how do I in my life do justice? How do I demonstrate that I love kindness, mercy, that I exercise the same kind of steadfast love that God exercises to us? And how do I do this while walking humbly with God day in and day out. The specific answers to those questions will be dependent on what it is that you see as you look at what lays before you in your life. Amen.